The main theme that I'm going over today is something that I have been interested in for a little bit, which is a particular tension that we have between just theories of quantum gravity in general, if you were to set one up, versus systems that have time dependence in them. So the way that I like to frame it is this. In quantum gravity, the only things that we can really talk about as physical computable questions are really asymptotics. So because you have diffeomorphisms, which are your gauge symmetries, this restricts you to talking about physically things like computing S matrices, and this is what you get in string theory from the world sheet. The only thing that really ends up computing is an S matrix. Or in the case of ADS CFT, you have a boundary CFT that really defines the theory on the ADS background. And this is nice, but more generally, if we're talking about non-equilibrium systems slash systems with explicit time dependence, in general, you can't compute these things. So in general, there isn't a notion of an S matrix that goes along with those systems. There are some very special systems in like condensed matter where you can have something like an S matrix. But in general, this is not what you're interested in computing. And the reason why is because the adiabatic theorem breaks down. So in general, if I have something like, example one would be my Hamiltonian has some time independent part plus potential that explicitly has time dependence. It's not generically the case that I can slowly turn this both on and off. It could be the case that you just start with something that's time independent, slowly turn it on, but it's unclear how you'd actually be able to turn this off. A lot of times the results that you end up getting depend on switching procedure and stuff like that. The other example would be if I have some initial state, which is defined by a density matrix at, let's say, just time is equal to minus infinity, just in general, all abstractly represented as this. These are not necessarily eigenstates of the Hamiltonian that show up here. And so, again, your adiabatic theorem breaks down. And so instead, the things that you're generally interested in computing here are finite real-time operator expectation values. And so the problem with this, in the context of string theory, at least, this is kind of the what I think is a little bit of a deep question, is, well, if you're essentially only restricted to doing this in these time-dependent systems, and you have a situation, say, in like cosmology, where you have, at least for the semi-classical background, it's explicitly time-dependent. So when you look at fluctuations about that background, the Hamiltonian for the fluctuations would have explicit time dependence. You're cutting off at a finite real time is kind of like trying to compute something that's off shell. And such a question shouldn't really be answerable in a full theory of quantum gravity because the physical things that we're really computing are S matrix elements because we don't have off shell local gauge invariant observables. So so basically, the who cares of all this is really just a, if we're dealing with something like cosmology, the way the cosmologists deal with computing things like an inflation is just like what I said, which is that the expectation values are taken at some finite real time. You impose initial conditions on your fields, but you're not allowed to impose final conditions like you would have to for an S matrix. And the Hamiltonian has explicit time dependence. Another example of where you'd actually care about this in a gravitational setting is when you're studying black holes. So in black holes, while cosmology was more of an example of one, black holes would be more of an example of two, where to someone who is outside of the black hole horizon, it appears like you have some mixed state for your system. So in both of these situations, it would be more appropriate, or I'd say satisfying, if there is some place in string theory where we could fundamentally point to that would generate these sorts of questions and resolve, you know, what is the actual thing that string theory would be able to compute. So the solution to dealing with this in quantum field theory is already pretty well known. The way that you do these computations is with a technique called the Kaldish-Schwinger technique. There's a bunch of other names, so you may have heard the informalism. That's what cosmologists will call this. The other thing is a closed time path integral. So in QFT, I'll just call it Kaldish contour is what we're interested in. And so like I said, the things that we can actually compute is I have some operator and it's evaluated at some finite time. I want to take an expectation value with respect to some density matrix. And this is a pretty well-known thing of how to do. So this is the formula for that. And if you want to write it in terms of sums over states, there's one over the normalization condition. You can basically break this up into a weighted sum. That's an N. And in particular, the reason that I'm writing this out is just to demonstrate that there's two pieces of this. One is that there's this backward propagating component. And this is the Hamiltonian and the interaction picture. There's the operator that you're evaluating at time, the expectation value at time t. And then there's this forward propagating component. And I'm running out of space on the board. There we go, perfect. So in terms of actually writing this in a path integral language, the way that you would do that is that you want to encapsulate both that we evolved from some in state, and we're weighting the in state by this over here, and then we evolved to the time that we want to evaluate the expectation value of the operator, and then we evolved backwards such that the bras and cats are both defined at t is equal to minus infinity. And so it's pretty straightforward of what the path integral looks like for this. It turns out that to do this like time, anti-time ordering, all that you have to do is evaluate your action on a closed time path. And so if I wanted to take an expectation value at a bunch of different times, so I have some product of operators, it's a straightforward generalization. And so the closed time path that you're actually evaluating this over is if this is my time axis t, and this is like your imaginary time axis, you can represent rho generically as some exponential of another operator. And typically, so I'll say in an equilibrium situation, lambda is your inverse temperature, k is equal to your Hamiltonian. And for a generic non-equilibrium system, this is not necessarily the case. This does not need to be a local expression in phi. And this is not your temperature. But what you can do is use this to say, I'm going to do time evolution along here with respect to my action. And then I just time evolve backwards and time evolve down by an imaginary time lambda. Typically, what we're interested in field theory is that you, even though you don't have the power of adiabatic theorem anymore, you can start with just a equilibrium density matrix. You set some temperature for the system, and then you turn on but don't turn off a non-equilibrium perturbation to the system. And so typically, you're not terribly interested in the most general setting. And so where this is going is that in order to avoid having to deal with this closed time contour, instead what you can do is just double your degrees of freedom. So you can define phi plus, which lives on the forward branch, phi minus lives on backward branch. And so by doing this, you can actually split the path integral up into two different pieces. There'll be some sort of integral over initial conditions, which you can usually ignore. And so I'll write it out explicitly, though, just to emphasize a fairly important point. So these are just initial conditions. And over here, starting from some configuration phi naught on the plus side and some configuration phi naught minus on the minus side, all we have is an action, or a path integral rather, that looks like this. So the key point here is that there's these two pieces, and the reason that I wrote this out is because it looks like this is all disconnected, right? So the phi plus fields don't interact with the phi minus fields, but they're connected by these initial conditions. Typically, we can just ignore the fact that there's these initial conditions there anyway, and instead write things in a very convenient way. And the convenient way is to just write this in terms of a 2x2 Green's function, so if we take our action and instead write it something like this, so A and B live on either the plus or minus branch, so they're either forward or backward propagating degrees of freedom. The Green's function then is a 2x2 matrix where there is your time-ordered Green's function, so just the Feynman propagator propagator that has anti-time ordering. So these are the plus plus components. This is the minus minus, also known as the Dyson propagator. And then there's the Whitman functions. I don't know how to pronounce things. That's the first time I said that out loud. So this is a minus plus, and this is plus minus, I believe. And so generically, the off-diagonal terms are not zero, again, because there are initial conditions that connect the two. And so even at zero temperature, they're not zero. So just as an example to have in our heads before we move on to the actual stringy piece of this, thermal real-time propagator would look like this. And this is in momentum space. So there's a zero temperature component. And like I said, there's going to be off-diagonal terms. And I'm using mostly a plus signature. So this over here corresponds to an on-shell out particle. This is on-shell in. And this is just complex the lower piece in the diagonal is just the complex conjugate on the upper piece. And then there is, thank you. Yep. And then there is the piece that you get from the thermal ensemble. And of course, this is just for bosons. And so I'm not really going to go into too many details about the structure of all this, but there's a lot of nice properties that are imposed by, so if we're dealing with just flat space, CPT invariants, and also unitarity, which restrict the form of these functions. The important piece, though, is that as a result of trying to compute these finite real-time expectation values, we end up being forced, essentially, to consider this type of contour in which we can double our degrees of freedom and get this particular structure for the propagator, which will affect what a stringy version of this has to look like. So the real problem with trying to figure out what a stringy version of this is one, like I said before, it's not entirely obvious how you would just very easily generalize these things. And the second problem is that there's really not a good like quantitative entry point. And so the first question that we really just want to ask ourselves is, how would strings just see the Keldysh contour? So this is some sort of structure that we're expecting to get. We just want to see, you know, assuming that there is some sort of world sheet description that takes into account the Keldysh contour, what would it actually look like? And so the goal would be to do that, and the strategy is to be a little bit clever. So if you just take a large N like adjoint field theory, so this can just be Young Mills, you can take a scalar field that's an adjoint that lives in the adjoint representation of like SUN. There's some at least qualitative relation between this and then what looks like some sort of string world sheet expansion. And so we know how to do this at zero temperature. We know how to do this at a finite temperature when we wick rotate time. So the stupidest thing that you could possibly think of is just do this in real time for some sort of generic density matrix that you write down and see if there's any universal features that pop up. Now, The other thing to point out too is that the most naive thing that you think is, well, there's going to be some forward propagating part and backward propagating part, and that's all that you're really going to get. And so you think that this is actually not really going to give you anything terribly useful, and you're just going to be stuck with, well, I'm not really sure what to construct here. It turns out the answer is a little bit more interesting than that. So with regular large N expansions, so let's say that we have Young-Mills theory. If we have a coupling constant G, which is just defined inside of the covariant derivative, we can rescale A in such a way and then rename whatever our A prime is back to A, such that our action just looks like this. So whatever the action for Young-Mills was with a coupling constant of 1, G gets pulled out as G squared. Keep a fixed diff coupling while we take N goes to infinity and G goes to 0. And the result for this is already pretty well known, but it's probably pretty important to write down what everything just looks like because a lot of the features end up getting repeated. So the different components that we have for this type of expansion is that we have vertices. And in the double line notation, where since A is an adjoint field, we can represent it in terms of a fundamental and anti-fundamental indices. And so we get the double line. So we have a vertex, which scales as N over lambda. We have propagators, which are our edges in any diagram, which scale as lambda over N. And then we have closed color loops, which are the faces, which scale as N. Pretty straightforward. The result that we end up getting is also pretty well known, that there ends up being, when you look at the expression for the effective action, this is just proportional to some sum over the different genera. N to whatever the Euler characteristic of the diagram is, which is given by vertices minus edges plus faces. Whatever the lambda dependence is really isn't too important because you could have other couplings and such. And then, and this is the important part for the generalization, there's some product over all of the different lines that we have in the diagram, the different strips rather. And they're decorated by whatever the propagators are for the theory. And so the similarity to string theory really just ends up being that this looks like inverse string coupling constant. And if we're just summing over all the diagrams in an organization by powers of 1 over n, then we know that something is going to go on the strips that we have. It's not necessarily clear how that turns into a string theory generically, but at least qualitatively it looks like there's some hope. And so all that we're looking for is qualitative hope in this situation too. Now, the real thing that's different here is that we just have these forward and backward propagating components. And so that means that we have some sort of generalization, but at first glance, it's not terribly exciting what we get. So we do have two vertex classes. So there's the plus class and the minus class where, so for instance, for a 3-point, you'll have something that looks like this where there's all pluses. and all minuses for this. And so this is what the Kalda-Schwinger formalism tells you is allowed. You're not allowed to actually mix these. The only way that you're allowed to mix them is that you have four propagator types, which I'm conveniently erasing. So with the four propagator types, you can just connect plus pieces or just connect minus pieces, but then you can also connect minus to plus, plus to minus, and this is how you can actually glue the two different segments together. And because these are non-zero, even at zero temperature, they're actually, you know, going to get glued together. So we can take expectation values of, say, like a phi minus and phi plus. And the last piece is that we just have closed loops, and there's really three main types here. In a certain sense, there's also three main types of the propagators, because you can always rewrite one of these in terms of one of these and the one of the others in the diagram, it turns out. So there's really closed plus, closed minus, and then mixed. So you can have a loop that actually mixes the plus and minus pieces. But here's the disappointing part, which is that if you were to just naively look at this, because phi plus and phi minus both came with the same counting in n, we didn't have a different theory for phi plus and phi minus by construction. It looks as though we just get effectively the same expansion, except now over here, and I'll just take this and modify it, we're going to have a few other terms. So the other terms that we have is that we have some a, b, c, j, k, l, m, n. So for different neighboring with the appropriate time or anti-time ordering vertices, there's going to be time-ordered decorations that go along with adjacent and time-ordered xi and xj points on the diagram. We can write everything in terms of the less than propagator that we had before. It's not necessarily the case that these are, that we can write a minus sign anymore, so I'll just write a comma. So going from xl to xm, so these were plus, xl is plus x, kl. Xk is plus, xl is minus, so there's a dxk plus dxl minus, dxm minus dxn minus, you get add in there. We decorate the ones, the parts of the diagram where we're connecting the plus and minus side by a different propagator, the less than propagator, and then the anti-time ordered propagator connects all of the minus components. So it looks pretty disappointing to start with. But there's a very interesting thing that you can note, which is that if we were to just play pretty fast and loose for a second, and it turns out that there actually is some field theory construction that gives you the same scaling as this, which will be published in whatever paper that ever comes out for this, you can think about how you would try to change n in such a way that maybe there actually is some sort of cogent way of splitting up this diagram. And so one cogent way that you can try to split this up is by saying, well, what if we have a n plus for all the plus pieces and an n minus for all the minus pieces? And it turns out that that gives you complete nonsense. And the reason it gives you complete nonsense is because if you try to work out what the Euler characteristic is, there actually isn't a good way of, or like an invariant way of writing that down, mostly because you have edges which come mixed. They come mixed with plus minus, and you also have faces which come mixed with plus minus. And so if you were to just, again, play fast and loose and say, I'm going to have an n plus, n minus, and some n wedge component, and so whenever I have a mixed loop, I get this, and then and wedge inverse for a mixed propagator. There's no mixed vertices, so we don't need to worry about that. And then these are for pure plus or minus loops, edges, and vertices. You get whatever the appropriate scaling is. It turns out that you can write down something that has the appropriate relations that you want, which is namely that in the effective action, we'll have a scaling which goes as n plus going to some chi plus, n minus goes to some chi minus, and n wedge goes to some chi wedge. So for the plus and minus, it's pretty straightforward. And again, for the wedge, there aren't any vertices for the wedge piece. So but what this allows you to do is just see that they're actually probably, you know, if we were to have some sort of string world sheet theory that perceives what the Keldysh contour is, there should be three different components of this. And there is what I would consider a fairly uninsightful way that you can write a field theory down that would give you these scalings and then reduce to the Keldysh-Springer formalism once you set n, all the n's equal to one another. But really the purpose of this is just to show that there actually is some way of breaking everything up so that these are not just arbitrary, random, some sort of random construction that you're pulling out of thin air. And so there is one complication to this as well, which is that these n's that I have here, just the regular big n where they're all equal to one another, shows up in some other places as well. Namely, when you write down your density matrix and you rescale your fields, the fields get rescaled that show up in the exponent of the density matrix as well. And so generically, you should also, so this is the under the rug piece of all this, is that generically the density matrix is giving you e to the minus n type contributions. And so this will show up as soon as you turn a temperature on in the system. And there isn't any good way of organizing these contributions. So in terms of what is actually topologically invariant, I don't really know what to say about these, but I do know what to say about just the power counting. And so I'll give you a couple examples to show why this is a little bit weird. So first off, like I said, you'd expect normally that there's just a plus and minus component if you were to just try to like armchair physicist this one away, but there isn't. So the simplest diagram that I could write down is something that looks like this. There's a plus piece, there's a minus piece, and there's a wedge piece. And so this is what the Riemann surface would look like. And the corresponding one corresponding diagram that would go along in this expansion that's very simple is having a plus vertex and a minus vertex and just propagators connecting all of these. And so if you do the counting, this has Euler characteristic 1 because there's a boundary. This has Euler characteristic 0. It's a cylinder. This has 1. So you get the right counting. And likewise, if I were to look at all the different wedge type propagators, the right vertices in which faces go at the wedge, we also get the corresponding counting that goes with that Riemann surface. And so that's a simple, silly diagram. And all this is really saying is that, you know, there's some part of the world sheet that's going to perceive the forward branch, some part that perceives the backward. And it looks like there's some cylinder that connects them, and we have no clue what that actually looks like a priori, or what it's actually functioning as. And you'd think maybe this is some nasty thing that you can just get rid of and collapse and just turns into some boundary and then you go along your merry way. And there's some examples, some other examples of diagrams you can draw where that looks like it's going to be the case. So this is a genus 1 diagram where on the plus side we have some genus 1 contribution, wedge side that's connecting both of these is just a cylinder again, and then on the minus side, that is just going to be a disk. So 1, 0, minus 1 because there's a boundary. We add them all up. We get 0 as expected. And a particular diagram that would go along with this is something that looks like this. So this would be a minus vertex. There's a bunch of plus vertices. I think that gives you the right one. These might be minus vertices, but that can easily be checked. But basically, there is some arrangement of these such that the genus one piece shows up only on one side of the diagram. And then things start to get a little bit weird. So there's diagrams that also look like this, where along the actual donut, I get a pair of pants for my wedge. And you can draw what Riemann surfaces are actually giving, or what ribbon diagrams are giving rise to these Riemann surfaces. So this is one of the contributions. So this is a 0, minus 1, 1. So we get the right counting. If I have 3 plus vertices and 1 minus vertex, I end up getting some contribution that looks like this. And so this looks hopeful that maybe you can ignore whatever this wedge piece is and then just, you know, derive something where a string sees just a plus component and a minus component, and that's about it. And, you know, it looks, that would look pretty similar to what you'd expect from the field theory side. But then there's 2 more examples that become very, very strange without any further study of what these actually mean.
Sorry, I was distracted 15 minutes ago, and I missed the plus or minus definition. Can you remind me what plus or minus?
Yeah, so the plus or minus definition is that if we are computing these time-dependent expectation values, because our operator is evaluated at some finite time, and we start at some state to find it like t is equal to minus infinity, there's time evolution forward to where the operation operator is evaluated at in time, and then time evolution backwards. So if we were to write a path integral description for all of this, we would have a closed time contour, which actually takes into account the fact that we have evolution both forwards and backwards in time when we're doing these sorts of calculations. And the plus and minus pieces is just a convenient splitting in terms of saying part of the field lives on the forward propagating piece of the contour, part of the field lives on the backward propagating piece. And so because you have both of those, while they don't necessarily interact with vertices, they are correlated because of initial conditions. And so that's why you end up with these mixed type propagators and then the 2 different vertex types. So in terms of the actual where we're going with this, like I said, This is just a gut check of how would strings actually perceive such a contour in a world sheet description, regardless of what that actual world sheet description is. And like I said, there'd probably be a forward and backward propagating piece, but this wedge piece looks kind of hard to interpret of what's actually going on. And so there's some examples that you can draw that show that you can't ignore it. So, in particular, this is very confusing. This has a ribbon diagram that definitely gets associated to it, so you know at least one diagram is giving a contribution to this. It's just like the other ribbon diagram we drew over there, except there's 2 plus and 2 minus vertices. And so when you take into account the edges that are these intermediate wedge pieces, those are the pieces that give rise to this donut component of the full diagram. So this is a minus 2, this is a 1, this is 1, and we still get the correct counting, and that can also be verified there by looking at the vertices, faces, and edges. And the other thing that starts getting weird too is that you can have multiple components.
Sorry, I think I'm still lost.
Yes.
How would things be weird if we just have a field theory where the fields are in the adjoint, and we know how to do perturbation theory, and these graphs are just graphs that appear in the perturbation theory.
Well, that's...
All seems to be weird.
How do you describe strings?
It's the idea of...
He wants to see what a string in a time-dependent situation.
Yeah.
What the string theory would be.
Yeah, so the real crux of all this is, let's say you have a time-dependent background or you have some mixed state, which is your defining your initial state for a system. It's not necessarily the case that you can define an S matrix anymore. And so in terms of what a string worldsheet description of this type of system would look like, we don't even have a qualitative understanding of how you would write that down, if one even exists. And so the idea is take a field theory where we know how to do that calculation, which is to use this double time, this closed time path where you end up doubling your degrees of freedom with the field theory, and see what is the corresponding string worldsheet type expansion that you should expect once you write a worldsheet theory down. What you can then do afterwards is you can do this for like just critical string theory and actually see what all these regions end up looking like, and you can at least have a starting point for constructing something that's a little bit more non-trivial and more quantitative. So to finish up the qualitative part, this is the most confusing piece, which is that you do have some intermediate region that you can't ignore. So in field theory, you normally just have these plus and minus components. In string theory, it turns out you have this extra intermediate region that's connecting them that actually has some sort of non-trivial topological property that means that you can't just collapse these down to boundaries. The last weird thing that you can have that's worth pointing out is that you can have diagrams that end up looking like this, where there's multiple plus components that are disconnected from each other. You can also have multiple disconnected minus components and then wedge components that actually connect them all together. And so in this case, you would actually have a diagram that looks something like, very quick on this, try to get to the other stuff. Something like this, where these are all plus vertices that we're putting together. So these are the plus pieces. These are minus vertices in the middle. And then there's something. The simplest thing you could possibly do is this. So if these are minus vertices over here, this would give rise to this, and they both have the same Euler characteristics for each individual component. So if you just want to brute force check these, you know that there is some, at least some diagram that corresponds to this. So this looks very unexpected from what you would just normally get from the field theory. And it's pretty easy to interpret what you'd expect from the plus and minus pieces, which is that from the string theory point of view, there should be some string type description which deals with forward propagating degrees of freedom, like the ones we have in our world. There's some mirrored piece. And then there's something that has to connect both of these together. And it can have some non-trivial topology, whatever that piece is. So that's the whole like diagrammatic portion of this, and I don't have, how much time do I actually have?
About 15 more minutes.
Okay, yeah. So I don't have a ton of time, but I'll give you a sketch of where this is going with the string side. Before I do that, I want to just mention that if you did want to worry about initial conditions, and this happens in, or final conditions, whatever floats your boat, this happens in cosmology, where you are worried about correlations with some initial configuration for your system, then you can do the following, which is that the part of the path integral that was setting up the initial conditions can be represented as some Euclidean, some integral over the field defined over Euclidean time. And so then you have three different components, plus, minus, and all of them are separated minus the fact that they're connected by boundary conditions. And boundary conditions make it so that you end up with a 3x3 propagator. And in the notation I was using before, this is the field that's defined on the Euclidean piece of the integration contour. We just get its own little piece over here. Normally, this is just going to be thermal, but you could also have it in, where this actually has interactions. You could have it so that there's three-point or four-point pieces of that. And the skinny of this is really just that you're going to actually have seven different region types. So the most interesting thing actually comes from when you mix all these together. So there's a Euclidean piece, there's a plus piece, and a minus piece. So those just have their own pure and E and plus and minus associated with them. You can mix plus and minus still, but now you can mix plus and E or minus and E. And the last region type that you can have is plus, minus, and E. And what's interesting about this is that while these have vertices, edges, and faces associated with them, these are still only going to have edges and faces because there's no vertices that are similar to all these. And over here, there's just going to be faces. So there's no propagator that is of plus, minus, and E type, just because that would require three fields. And so what's actually happening topologically is that anytime you have one of these, this basically just encloses the whole diagram. It's just a disk that connects everything together. So you could, for instance, go back to like 1988, and there was the Attic-Whitten paper on thermal strings, and you could try to consider, well, what is the real-time version of that story? And they talk about it a little bit of like, well, there isn't really a real-time formulation of this. The real-time formulation would have to have these components in it just because that is what we're getting from the large engage theory picture, unless there's some simplification that comes in. And so the sketch that I wanted to move into has to do a little bit with what that simplification looks like in a very simple example. So the simplest possible example that you could think of, which is actually helpful and non-trivial, but a very easy one, is what if we just look at critical bosonic string theory in Minkowski space at t is equal to 0. So I've been trying to find a lot of different examples that I could use for something like this. And it turns out this is actually the simplest thing that you could possibly write down for the following reasons. One, we know the vertex operators. So the vertex operators, regardless of whether we're propagating forward in target space-time or backward in target space-time, are known. The backwards ones are related to the forwards ones because it just flips the sign of the target space energy in the vertex operator. Two, we might not know what the path integral looks like for this description yet, but we know how to do this in the operator formalism. So the silliest thing that you could think about doing is just reverse engineering. And so what we don't have yet for this is a fully fleshed out version of the path integral, but we at least have some clues of where this is leading, and it looks like it's pretty doable to put something together. The reason that you would actually even care about this example is as follows, which is that the way in normal string theory that you build up other spacetimes is with the coherent states. So you can take a coherent state of vertex operators, and I can build up some g mu nu that ends up entering into the string path integral. And then by requiring that it remains Weyl invariant, you get Einstein's equations that come out of that. And so you'd hope that with this picture, you'd be able to build up coherent states of vertex operators on either side, and you'd be able to generate some restrictions on what the spacetimes can be on either side in the target space. And so in particular, hopefully this gives some sort of leg in to figuring out how would we deal with time-dependent scenarios from a more fundamental stringy point of view. And that's more of a dream right now, but the starting point is really with just critical string theory. So normally the way that we actually work with all with the operator formalism, which, you know, in Polchinski, I don't think it's really even gone over very much because it's all about path integrals. But we know what the mass shell condition for a physical state should be. And so basically what that means for a Euclidean Green's function is that it's just equal to this, which has some representation in terms of Schringer parameters. C to the L dot minus 2, I believe it is, yep. And so this is what ends up entering in to the computations that you want to do, which basically are as follows. You take some out state, which you can represent in terms of vertex operators. And for whatever diagram at tree level that you want to compute, you insert vertex operator. You have your Euclidean Green's function. And it turns out that you can also just insert a Lorentzian type Green's function with the appropriate analytic continuation. To get whatever the version of this amplitude should be in the correct signature. So your amplitudes for an endpoint amplitude will go like this, e to the m minus 2. And so what's neat about this is that without knowing what the path integral description is, the stupid thing you can do is just insert the propagators in. You can insert a Lorentz signature propagator if you want. And then if you know what the different vertex operators in the theory are, you just insert as many as you want, and you can do the calculation kind of brute force like that. And so what that means, though, is that if we know what the wedge type propagator is that's connecting things, we can insert.
It's just the amplitude,
right? Just the amplitude, yeah. So it's just an endpoint amplitude. It's going to look like this in the operator formalism. It's nothing terribly deep on its own. And this is, like, you can find this, and this is only for tree level, right? So if this was operator formalism for one loop, you need to add a trace in here. And if you were doing higher loops, then you can't actually do this. You need to introduce whatever the vertex should look like for interactions. And, like, you can find a lot of this in Green Shorts, but it's very old school stuff. But this is the only way that I knew without a path integral to try to dive into at least figuring out what the heck this should look like. And so the key component of all this is knowing what propagators to put in. And so we already know for the time-ordered propagator what this is going to look like at zero temperature. It's going to look something like this. So you just add the minus I epsilon by hand. And likewise, for the anti-time ordered piece, we're going to have just the opposite I epsilon part. The only other propagator we really need to worry about is this less than propagator. And the reason why is that when we do the Kalda-Schwinger path integral, everything gets time contour ordered, meaning that all your phi minus type operators get put to the left of phi plus type operators. It's just like time ordering, except you take into account that you're evolving over the contour. So when you're going backwards in time, phi minus goes to the left. So the amplitudes that we're really interested in look something like this, where we have a bunch of these v minus vertex type operators, anti-time ordering. Let's say we have an m minus 1 on the minus side, m on the minus side. And we're going to the plus side. There is a less than propagator that goes in between them. Time ordered propagators between the plus pieces. And then we have an in state, which was phi n. So this is what this would look like. This is the only piece at tree level that we really need to worry about that's a little bit different. And so this is, again, this is a little bit of a sketch. So this is something like, one way that you can, there's a couple ways that you can get this. One way is through noting that there is this relation that must hold. In the Kalda-Schwinger formalism, and this piece has a negative p-naught that comes with it. The other piece has the positive p-naught part. This is just an infinite sum of delta functions of point particles. And so one way that you can justify this to yourself so we can all sleep at night is we know how to do the Kalda-Schwinger stuff for point particles. And so we're really just doing this for an infinite collection of point particles. And so we just need some representation of this delta function. Yes?
Can I also just say that that's like the principal value representation of the delta function given in terms of those two rational functions?
I think that you can, yeah, I think
that's almost exactly what's going on. If I take epsilon to zero.
Yeah, if you take epsilon to zero, yeah, that's exactly what you're getting. Right, because if you were to just do this with the epsilon being non-zero, you're going to have epsilon's there. You have to take epsilon to zero so that in the sense of distributions, you would get a delta function out. That's correct. So basically, the last remaining piece of this is that, you know, for amplitudes that you would normally compute if you were just being naive and don't know how to do path integrals, you just insert the correct propagators in. And we can just insert this into here. And there's a couple different representations that you can get of the delta function. So for instance, one.
Sorry for being so slow. Maybe it's obvious, but you started with an amplitude, right? It's a usual scattering amplitude. I have some particles in the past, some particles in the future, depends on the sign of the energy.
Correct.
Now, am I understanding correctly that you are now defining a new object that is not a scattering amplitude because I use different type of propagators?
It's
This is new, right?
Correct. So this is like.
What is it equal to? What's the definition of this object?
Well,
it's just a formula without an equal sign.
Right. So if we were to think about this in terms of what's happening with these propagators, this is just a correlation function that we're getting, or an expectation value. So the difference really is that if this is a world sheet in state, and this is a world sheet out state, these are represented by vertex operators. The vertex operators that I can have here can be outer in states on the target space, then here, this is going to be some in state on the world sheet. This is some in state on the world sheet. And so it's just a normal expectation value that I'm taking if I were to pull these out, and then just an expectation value with respect to the vacuum state of the world sheet. In terms of what this looks like on a strip, so remember, these are basically going to go as e to the negative, this is a Euclidean signature, e to the negative t l naught minus 1 on the world sheet. And all this is doing is creating a strip. And if we're evaluating from alpha to beta on either side, there's some state alpha, which is the out state, some state beta, which was my in state, and we evolved over some Euclidean world sheet time t. That's physically what's happening. So in terms of this picture over here, what we're doing is, you know, going from right to left, we start with some phi n. I'm inserting a bunch of vertex operators along here of the plus type. I then have this wedge piece, which is just creating a wedge that connects the two different regions. And then I, because I'm going backwards in time, it turns out this is also backwards in world sheet time, inserting vertex operators here, I'm just evolving back to the initial world sheet time. And so I'm really actually computing some sort of in scattering amplitude, which is not necessarily a priori obvious, but once you work out all the pieces, that's what it ends up being. So the main point, though, is that you can take.
Just for my education, what is a NIMSC? I don't know what this word is. What is a NIMSC?
Well, just like in quantum mechanics, if I were to take, you know, in regular quantum mechanics, I have some state psi psi, and I want to take some expectation value with respect to that state. I take that state, and then, you know, as a ket, I take that state as a bra, and then I take whatever operator I'm taking the expectation value with respect to and shove it in the middle. And if I want to evaluate that operator at different times, I have to do time evolution forward to where the operator is evaluated at, and then time evolution backwards, because generically, these are going to be in the same Hilbert space at some, you know, T0 that we're defining this with respect to. It's only the case in S matrices that we can get rid of, or ignore the fact that the in and out states are defined at different times, because we can adiabatically turn on and off interactions. And all that's going to happen is that this state is going to change by a phase from this state. And so we just kill the phase, and that corresponds to just getting rid of disconnected diagrams, like disconnected Feynman diagrams. So
but the mechanics, it's OK. I just asked, I mean, as scattering amplitude, normally we send particles from infinity, or if we want, we define it through correlation functions by LSZ. That's the usual amplitude. Right? Those, I think, I know what is the mean amplitude? That's
yeah.
The object. What is it?
It's a new
field theory.
It's an expectation value, just like in quantum mechanics. Like, even if you were to do in quantum field theory, I just have, like, you know, extra labels being position as well. So it's just taking an expectation value.
In the same before you're doing in, like in now and
yeah, so like with an S matrix, you have two different Hilbert spaces. Like I have my in Hilbert space and out Hilbert space, and they happen to be related. But whenever I have time dependence or I have some state which is not a pure state, it's not necessarily the case that you're guaranteeing that your Hilbert spaces are going to be related when you're taking the expectation value. So if I were to try to do S matrix calculations with this, I don't actually know what my late time behavior is going to be. So we just remain agnostic to it.
Okay. I think my confusion is because it looks to me like you switched from target space to world shift, and I got a bit confused. Because I thought
great.
Before, the point is when you were doing large N, you had points in target space, and they were either backwards or front.
Yeah.
The other thing which is different is on the world shift, right? Whether we evolve radially on the world shift, and it's
yeah.
not the same thing, right?
Yeah, so that will become clear in like a minute or two. Just to, you know, recap, the thing that we're computing in string theory always, you know, when we just have a Euclidean world sheet, is I have some amplitude that I can compute. I can use Euclidean propagators, or I can futz around with Lorentzian type propagators with interactions that are Wick rotated. And I'm really computing some sort of in out S matrix element, both on the world sheet and the target space. In the target space, the reason that it's an S matrix element is because these are basically, you know, points on the world sheet, so they're corresponding to like on-shell states. Once we move over to this picture, if I were to just set up stuff in the operator formalism, on the target space, we are still looking at asymptotic states. They just happen to be asymptotic states on, you know, either the backward propagating time branch and target space or the forward propagating time branch and target space. On the world sheet, we're also computing in an expectation value. That's the only thing that we're really allowed to compute. If we want to take you know, some sort of correlation function between both plus and minus operators. And so this is just naively how you would actually set up. I have, you know, this is exactly what you're doing in regular string theory, except now I'm doing it with both plus and minus vertex operators, which are given for you by for free just because we're dealing with Minkowski space at zero temperature. This is the setup. There's no restriction on these in terms of what the momenta are. So on the plus side, these can both be in or out states on target space. But in terms of the states that you're evolving to and from on the world sheet, it's an in expectation value. Basically, what's happening with this, it's very easy to write out. And it should be pretty clear what the interpretation could be of this. There's a couple different representations of the delta function, like I was saying. One representation is that I have a bunch of different vertex operators. So I have some intermediate momentum, and I have some anti-intermediate momentum. I'm going to sum over all J in the physical Hilbert space that have P naught is less than zero. So equal to minus whatever the on shell P is. D minus 1, P 2E for the intermediate state. So it looks something like this is what the delta function is giving you. This is one way of representing the delta function. Another way that you could try to represent the delta function is by saying, well, there is a analog to the Schwinger parameters, where I go something that looks like this. This is another representation for the delta function, which can be broken up into in the sense of distributions where I'm taking epsilon to zero. I think this is right. I might have the sign wrong, but again, we're taking epsilon to zero in this case, but I can break this up into something that looks like the sum of both of these propagators. It turns out that this actually has a pretty deep meaning in and of itself. But basically, the most useful thing to look at is this. What it looks like here, if I want to actually interpret what's going on, is I have some modification of the S matrix. The modification in the sense that I have world sheet in state, a bunch of stuff happening in the middle, and I'm summing over some intermediate states with a restriction. And I have another world sheet in state on the other side. So basically, the restriction on here, in the case of zero temperature, Minkowski backgrounds, is that these are positive, these are out states with respect to the plus side of the contour on the target space. And they're in states on the minus side of the contour because energy gets flipped. And so what it looks like you actually have is you have something where you're computing, you know, for each term in the sum, an S matrix element for the plus side, S matrix element for the minus side, and you connect them up by all the different, you know, physical out states that you could actually have that would go from plus branch to minus branch. And so it's a weird interpretation because you basically have it so that you still have some notion of some sort of like S matrixy type thing that string theory is computing, but it gets modified such that you're computing some sort of in expectation value on the world sheet still. And it's set up in such a way that that's through these two connected S matrices what you're reproducing on the target space. So basically, you know, the last point is that these two different representations of the delta function you can use to try to show, and this is what we're in the middle of right now, that there is actually some type of relation between these in scattering amplitudes or modifications of scattering amplitudes that you get and the Kutkowski rules that you would expect from regular zero temperature field theory. And it turns out that for Kalder-Schwinger theories in just normal point particle physics, this is actually the case, that the Kutkowski rules and the Kalder-Schwinger formalism are basically one and the same at zero temperature. So it turns out that this may have like some utility in just doing some proofs where there isn't really like a satisfactory proof of the Kutkowski rules in string theory. This might actually have some use immediately there. But the other use is that there's this weird interpretation. This is the weird thing that you at least get out at zero temperature for the structure that you get in string theory. And already, and this is the last thing I'll write down because I think I'm already over time, already you can see that it looks like just as there's this strange mapping between supersymmetry on the world sheet and supersymmetry in the target space, there may be some sort of analogous Kelder-Schwinger happening on the world sheet and Kelder-Schwinger happening on the target space. The reason why is because when you're looking at these time-ordered propagators, these are going as e to the minus I tau L naught minus 1. So this looks like you have forward propagating world sheet time. And for these backwards ones on the target space, you end up with backwards propagating world sheet time. And so if we were to try to write something out naively that's giving us the right amplitude, then you can work out a couple amplitudes yourself to see that this seems to be the case. The thing I would write down for the world sheet theory, at least at tree level, is I have some action for the plus fields minus some action for the minus embedding fields. And then there's some boundary conditions with some sort of sum over the boundary conditions on the fields, which would ostensibly relate or correlate these fields in such a way that there would be this type of intermediate propagator that you get. But this is not fully worked out, but it looks like at least these two components have to be in there. What the actual sum looks like is something that we're still working out, but it looks like maybe the conjecture is that there is some sort of duality between some Kelder-Schwinger type formalism on the world sheet and Kelder-Schwinger type formalism on the target space. And so this might be a way to start answering some questions about time-dependent, like semi-classical backgrounds, just from a stringy perspective and see what it's actually like spitting out more generically for some more complicated examples than something like this. So that's all I have. Any questions?
So, did you try looking at two-dimensional Yagnils? Just because it has this string basis expansion. It looks like all of these questions could be much simpler.
I did not try looking at two-dimensional Yagnils. My advisor actually did some work with 2D Yagnils. The reason we ended up starting with this is that it actually seemed like you could take more of a direct shot on goal, in the sense that, like, a lot of things come for free when you're dealing with just critical string theory. I'm not really sure what the supersymmetric case looks like just yet because we were working this out.
I only mean that there you could just say I have two-dimensional Yagnils and I'm interested in computing any type of correlation function, whatever they mean in that theory thought as a gauge theory, and then you can ask, well, what is the string basis expansion telling you?
No, that actually, I mean, that would also have a little bit more relevance to the large end story that's motivating a lot of this. Yeah, I mean, it's we were thinking of a couple different, like, 2D string theory type things we could do. This just happened to be the first one that we've tried so far, but there'd probably be an interesting one to try next.
Okay, so if you have anyone else has questions, you can come up and ask after, but I'll cut it off now. So let's thank them again.